gratitude in the scientific respect, because at that time, a distinguished Harvard scholar warned me strongly that writing a book is not the best way of furthering your career. There are so many books that get published and drop into the water like a stone into the water, drop into oblivion like a stone into the water. It was Abner who kept me going against this and not dropped the book before it was published. So thanks to that as well. Then a little homage to Abner. It happened to me so often when I turned to a problem that I realized Abner was there already. So I learned to be very careful. And of course, I learned a great deal from looking at Abner's work. I was so thrilled when I got to know Abner, how much agreement there is between our general outlooks. And it has come to the point, well, examples are what Abner says about the quantum mechanical worldview. I like his phrase of the foundation of physics as the enterprise of experimental physics. And in particular, I'm completely accord, I believe, on his view of quantum measurement as an actualization of potentialities. Having said that, I hope that after this talk, Abner will not point out too many points where he doesn't think he agrees with me. Anyway, it has really come to the point that often I'm tempted when I return to a problem, to a question area, that I think, what do I actually think about it? And then there's temptation to read it up, what I think about it in Abner's books. Anyway, I had two scientific encounters with Abner. On one occasion, I became what he calls his playmate. The first was to do with the so-called Wigner-Araki-Yanase theorem, which is to do with limitations on measurements due to conservation laws. I'll come to that a little later. The other is the quantum measurement problem, and we worked together on an extension of Abner's insolubility theorem. I'm showing this picture of our book not to advertise it. That would be pointless. It's out of print. But to indicate that this collaboration had a great impact on the shaping of the second edition of that book. The insolubility theorem became a core element of that. And I'm also not trying to advertise that book of ours. But to recall another point connected with that book, one reviewer of that book, who may be in the room here, there he is, criticized that this book, well, was not basically strictly operational, but interspersed was our, or perhaps my, pet interpretation of POVMs, positive operator valued measures, as the general representation of observables. We tried to keep the technical, physical, and interpretational issues separate, but apparently that wasn't entirely successful. But what I want to say is that we espoused there, well, a program that I'm still struggling with, of an interpretation of POVMs, which I would summarize in the catchphrase unsharp quantum reality. And connected to that, to describe my difficulties with that and why it's unfinished, I might refer to Jeffrey Hellman's boxes that he presented in his talk earlier this week. And I just have to say, I don't quite know which box to fit in. I might be in the superposition of two of them at least. This problem has been pestering me since my very first conference talk, which was a good 20 years ago, which had the title, Can Quantum Mechanical Reality Be Considered Sharp? Today, I'll refrain from going into these interpretational issues. I hope I do. At least they are not the subject of my talk. But I would hope that one of these days, Abner can show me the direction on how to solve this one. So what I'm going to talk about is captured by the phrase limitations on quantum measurements. I'll have a look, revisit some old myths in the light of very recent developments. There are some old and new challenges to the principles of complementarity and uncertainty, which go by the names of partly very famous people, but in any case, on more or less solid work. I'll review some disputed no-go claims and trade-off relations that have been presented to describe limitations on quantum measurements. I'll review some operational definitions of inaccuracy and disturbance due to measurement, and use these to give some more precise ideas. That's what I just said. One way of looking at, or one motivation for me to revisit this area is to do with a specific kind of quantum weirdness. We have heard about quantum weirdness to do with microsystems. But there is an instance of, I would say, of quantum weirdness, which is about the minds of quite a few among those concerned with quantum mechanics. And that's the persistence of myths and misconceptions, in particular concerning complementarity and uncertainty. To me, this demonstrates the need for clarification. As one of the speakers said, a new theory needs new words, and I would add intuitions to be developed. There was also the question on the measurement problem, should Shelley Glasher work on it? I may repeat the question here, should he? Maybe not, but somebody has to, and that's my apology. What I'm going to talk about is largely based on joint work with my Finnish friends, Pekka Lahti, Teiko Heinonen, Jukka Kiukas, and Kari Ilinen. Well, the devil is in the detail, as probably Abner would agree. And that means, I'm afraid to say, and I have a pretty high degree of belief on this account, at this stage of the conference, that this is, I'm afraid, going to be the most technical talk of all. So my apologies for that, but yeah. I'll try to be quick on those parts, and there are some nice non-technical parts as well to come, I hope. So here is the basics of the concepts, basic concepts of quantum measurement theory that I'm drawing on. This scheme, do I have a pointer? Yeah. I'd prefer these green, I'm just saying I prefer green. They had some nice green pointers earlier on. Anyway, this is our, who's doing that? Thanks very much. It's much stronger anyway. So now I have something to do with both hands. So that's a basic schematic of any measurement process. You have an object system in a preparation T, a density operator T, that describes its preparation. You have an apparatus or probe with a state, and they are coupled through an interaction. Then they go their ways, and I take a reading on the apparatus, and something is coming out about the object this way. So that's what we call a measurement scheme. These elements, the Hilbert space of an apparatus, its initial state, a unitary coupling, and a pointer. So at this point, you might wonder, why am I using T for states and Z for pointers? Well, this is a mix of languages. My Finnish friend Pekka taught me that T stands for the Finnish word of state, tulli. And he used it with his colleague Ilin in a book they wrote before we wrote ours. So he insisted that we adopt that letter. In exchange, I insisted in Z for pointer, which is the German word Zeiger. And I was happy with T because I certainly would have avoided W for state, because that would be Wissen, knowledge. Was I looking in a particular direction? So there we go, linguistic confusion. Yeah, I explained the elements here already. I guess there's not much more to say. What do we do with these elements? Well, here we are. What we call the measured observable in this is a positive operator valued measure, POVM, which assigns to all possible outcome sets a positive operator in such a way that the trace of T times that operator is the probability. And this expression is actually defined in terms of the output pointer probabilities. So that's what this equation is decisive to define the POVM in a measurement scheme, the measured observable. Likewise, we get an expression for a description of the state change, and that goes by the name of instrument. It's a following thing. It's a family of super operators, as some of you might call it. It's an operation, quantum operation, which sends states to non-normalized states in such a way that the initial state of the object ends up in a final state which has trace equal to the probability for that event to occur. So that's written down here, and the instrument is again defined in the language of the object alone in terms of the entities entering the measurement scheme. And again, the instrument is linked with the observable by that formula, giving the probability in different notations for that outcome X. There's an important fundamental theorem of measurement theory that goes back to work of Neumark in the 40s, Steinspring in the 50s, and then in the physics context, Ludwig, Krauss, Davies, and Ozawa, which says, well, the trivial part is that every measurement scheme induces a completely positive instrument. Spare me to explain that. Every instrument defines a unique observable, and that is in these formulas up there. The converse is the non-trivial part. For every observable, you have an infinity of mathematical measurement schemes realizing that observable by virtue of these formulas. So that's the non-trivial part, but quite reassuring because it says that quantum mechanics allows the measurement of any observable, at least a priori, unless there are further restrictions such as limitations of the accessible, available interactions or what have you. And we'll see some of those limitations shortly. So that's measurement theory in a nutshell. And that brings us to the main part of the talk. First I give broad brush statements of what goes not. And these are two little theorems which come out quite neatly and simply in this measurement theory formalism. So the first is that there is no measurement without state change. And that is formalized as follows. If we take the final state irrespective of the outcome, the final state of the object, and require it to be equal to the initial state of the object, and this to be true for every initial state of the object, then it turns out the measured observable in that scheme is trivial. And by that I mean the following. Let's take a pure state, input state. That can be decomposed in terms of the instrument into one state associated with the outcome X and one state associated with the complement outcome. Because this is a pure state, these component states have to be the same modulo normalization. And that is what I write here. And also by linearity of the instrument operations, it follows immediately with some trickery that this coefficient is independent of the input state. So using the measurement formulas, the measured observable comes out to be giving us probabilities independent of the input state. And that is what I call a trivial observable. Formally, it's this here. All the positive operators are multiples of the identity, and that's that. So if there is no state change in a measurement scheme, then there is no measurement. There is no information transfer. So there has to be some disturbance. There also has to be some entanglement. That's part of general folklore. Some people call both theorems fundamental theorems, but I haven't seen many proofs of it, so this is our preferred proof for it. Look at any unitary on a tensor product of two systems. require it to be non-entangling, such that for all input vectors of the two systems, the image gives us a product state again. Then it follows that U, the unitary, is of one of those two types. It's either a product map where each factor is a unitary on its respective Hilbert space, or in some situations you might have that swap, and then that is implemented by bijective isometries between the two Hilbert spaces. And that occurs, of course, only if the two Hilbert spaces for the object and the probe system have equal dimensions. So that's all you can get. And then by a continuity argument, well, yeah, you can certainly use that swap map in order to copy the information from the object to your probe system completely. But this takes time, and I only have a one time step shown here. The continuity of the unity revolution that has to do this requires, of course, then that this swap cannot be implemented by a continuous family of those transformations. So that proves that intermediately there has to have been some entanglement. So that's this. That shows what can't be done or what can't be hoped for. And then, of course, the obvious goal would be to quantify and then optimize trade-off, the trade-off between information gain and disturbance in a measurement. In the context of quantum information theory, this has been, I guess, pioneered by work of Ferris and Fuchs. Their approach and perspective is somewhat different to what I'm going to do here. I take a more traditional approach, looking at foundational issues, and therefore my quantum limitations are much to do with complementarity and uncertainty. Here's a quick and easy definition, nutshell definition of the complementarity principle, phrased in terms of canonically conjugate quantities such as position and momentum. And it says about them that setups for the definition and observation, that's Bohr's terms, or preparation and measurement of canonically conjugate quantities are mutually exclusive. So that's a verbal description, and I hasten to proceed to a formalization, and notice that I'm pointing out actually three, so the next slide will show the third, conceptually different variants. One is complementarity with reference to preparations, and then there are two versions of complementarity with reference to measurements. The first is, if I know, if the value of quantity Q is certain to occur in a measurement, then the other one, P, is completely uncertain in the sense that it's neither probability one or zero. In a somewhat sharpened version, that would say if Q is sharply defined, then P is uniformly distributed. We like to call that value complementarity. And that's quite popularly used. The first variant of measurement complementarity would say that there is no joint measurement, roughly speaking, and that can be captured by this property of position and momentum. Oh, by that notation, Q sub T of X, I refer to the probabilities. That is a very shorthand condensed notation for probabilities for an occurrence of an outcome in X. Q represents the spectral measure. Sub T is the state, and I take the trace of Q of X against T, and that's the shorthand notation for that. Likewise, these are the spectral projections of position and momentum associated with bounded intervals, and then it's a mathematical result from the Fourier theory, which says that the intersection is zero. There are no joint eigenstates that give probability one on bounded intervals. Well, there is a way of phrasing complementarity in terms of sequences of measurements, and that would say that here in our context, I put it that way, a sharp measurement of position destroys all prior information about momentum and vice versa. What do I mean by that? Well, first of all, I put it in the form of a theorem. First of all, if I imagine to do a sharp measurement of position first and follow that by a sharp measurement of momentum, So I get outcomes X and Y. That defines me actually a joint probability distribution. But of what? Well, of what is decided by looking at the marginals of that joint. The first marginal obviously is just position. The measured observable in that sort of scheme is position, sharply. The second observable is some sort of distorted momentum. And this theorem states that these effects, these positive operators for momentum, are actually functions of position. They commute with position, that's necessary, and then position being a maximal observable, it has to be, they have to be functions of position. So that's a terribly distorted way of measuring momentum. You get no information about momentum, but you get a shadow of the information that you got already from the position measurement, and that's all. This result, well, has been long known, but I have to admit myself, I've known it for ages, but it only struck me a couple of months ago when I was revisiting these things. It's pretty neat, and there's more to come along these lines. Now, turning to the uncertainty principle. Well, the usual way of phrasing the uncertainty principle is saying that it quantifies limitations of preparations and measurements. But I add, it does a little more than that. And can you recognize that picture? I can't because it's a bad angle from here. Well, can you fill in the dots up there? My belief is that perhaps half of you would say empty and half of you would say full. I don't want to make a public vote because it would probably disclose who is an optimist and who is a pessimist. What I want to say with this is that Heisenberg certainly was a great optimist compared to Pauli, for instance. It is said that Heisenberg always knew what worked and Pauli always knew what wouldn't work. And here we go. So I've learned to see this glass to be half full. And that's, here's why. The uncertainty principle, well, I make a confession here. I think it's as strong a principle as complementarity, although I know many people agree on that one. The uncertainty principle comprises a complex of ideas, partly positive, partly negative, and usually the focus is on the negatives. And here is what they say. Well, one idea is that measurement disturbs the observed system, so there's bound to be an information trade-off of some sort. There's reference to classical momentum kicks or the reduction of wave function as a way of describing that disturbance. Also, entanglement has been brought in here. It's said that this is a limitation of joint preparations and measurements. I fully agree with most of this, if understood properly. But there's more. And Heisenberg's point of departure in the 1927 paper was the realization that, he quoted Einstein on this, it came to him that Einstein had pointed out to him, it's the theory which decides what can be observed. And he used that here in the way that he said, well, we should stop worrying about the fact that the theory tells us there are no sharp trajectories. Actually, what the theory does tell us is, or ought to be telling us, is that there are fuzzy phase space trajectories. And that's what led him to formulating his idea of the uncertainty relations. And he would very much phrase it also in terms of the examples that he gave as the possibility, positive possibility of unsharp joint preparations and measurements of position and momentum. So that's my thesis, and I'll explain that in a little more detail shortly. But let me run through a list of myths and facts as I see them. And I encourage you to explore your conscience on each of those. And, well, maybe we can discuss this afterwards. So these are partly overlapping myths. There are seven or so in the list. Uncertainty relations are often described as formal expressions of complementarity and references given to Bohr. Others say they are more than that, and I would give reference to Bohr again here. And here's my favorite quote of Bohr on that one, and I read it to you. In the language of the relativity theory, the content of the relations to the uncertainty relations, may be summarized in the statement that according to the quantum theory, a general reciprocal relation exists between the maximum sharpness of definition of the space-time and energy momentum vectors associated with the individuals. This circumstance may be regarded as a simple symbolical expression for the complementary nature of the space-time descriptions and claims of causality. At the same time, however, the general character of this relation makes it possible to a certain extent to reconcile the conservation laws with the space-time coordination of observations. The idea of a coincidence of well-defined events in a space-time point being replaced by that of unsharply defined individuals within finite space-times, time regions. This red emphasis is, of course, mine, and I have it there because I only realized again a couple of weeks ago that it's not me, but Bohr who introduced this Teutonic word into physics. Great, so I'm free to use it. I was accused of that by some people. Myth two, the position momentum uncertainty relation is due to classical momentum kicks. Again, the reference is to Heisenberg, and that's wrong, according to Heisenberg. He believed it when he went, until the paper was in print, and then he added a note in the paper that saying, acknowledging that Bohr taught him the correct way of seeing this. It's not the kicks that account for uncertainties, but it's the dual nature, the quantum nature of the probe, the photon, that does it. There is a kick that transforms the, that gives the information, and there is the aperture and the wave nature of the photon that gives the uncertainty in being able to infer the momentum as well. The principle of complementarity is much deeper than the uncertainty relation. This is probably an exact quote of Scully, Englert, Walter in Nature 1995. There was a fight going on over this for quite a while in the late 90s. Until somebody tells me how to define deep here, I can only say it ain't that simple, and we wrote a big paper about this to try, well, not only about this point, but there's a long discussion yet, and I don't want to open it. The uncertainty principle has no bearings on possibilities or limitations of joint measurements. I think that's due to Popper, Margnau, Ballantyne, and many others. I say that's wrong. Why, we'll see. Quantum mechanics does not allow any joint measurements of position and momentum whatsoever. That's folklore, but I had it in personal conversations with distinguished quantum opticians when we showed them the Husimi distribution and the like, namely phase space POVMs, observables. They kept insisting at first. In the meantime, they know better. They kept insisting, well, this can't be, these have got to be pseudo-probabilities. So what's behind this statement? Well, there's the result of Wigner, who tried to find a phase-space distribution with the sharp position and momentum distributions being the marginals. And he ended up with the Wigner function, which is a way of formulating a no-go theorem. It says there is no joint phase-space distribution with the sharp marginals, full stop. It's not always positive. In most cases, it won't be positive. But there is Husimi, and I'm not sure about the year exactly. I pulled that down from memory. And he gave positive phase-space distributions of the proper quantum mechanical form on phase-space. But the marginals, of course, weren't sharp position and momentum. What they were, well, actually smeared position and momentum distributions with a fixed smearing function coming from a quantum state itself. So this has been known for a long time, and the Husimi distribution has always been in the shadow of the Wigner distribution because that turned out to be extremely powerful mathematically. Arthurs and Kelly gave an explicit model of a joint unsharp measurement based on a model of an unsharp position measurement that goes back to von Neumann, 1932, on the last pages in his book. I come to that, well, I hope. Quantum mechanics, well, and this goes on, let me do the timeline completely here. So since the 1970s, we know how to describe joint measurements in terms of phase-space POVMs. And since the 1980s, we have quantum optical realizations, and people are now looking into proper joint measurements of position and momentum for atomic objects as well. And what's the benefit of all this? I was tempted to put in here the phrase of another talk I gave once, less is more. Less precision in the observables, in the definition of the observables, provides often more information about the quantum state. And it turns out that those phase-space observables, many of those, have the property of being informationally complete, which means that if you have the statistics, they tell you what the state is. So that's a good single observable measurement of what people usually deal with as a quorum for quantum state tomography. The fifth myth, quantum mechanics does allow arbitrarily accurate joint measurements of position and momentum. And again, this is going back to Popper and Margenau. I don't want to enter that too much here. I only say this, given the notion of joint measurement as a phase space observable, theirs is a funny and very limited notion of joint measurement. And it lacks the property of controllability. There are too many states to which it applies to be able to do calibration of those experiments. So it's a very ad hoc sort of thing that they are trying. So I won't say more on that. But there is a mathematical, very recent fact. Well, the fact has been discovered very recently in work of Reinhard Werner, Gianni Cassinelli, and his collaborators. And that says that uncertainty relations for the measurement inaccuracies are actually necessary in any conceivable joint measurement represented by a joint observable for uncharted positions and momenta. They're necessary. The accuracy disturbance uncertainty relation is not universally valid. And that's due to Ozawa of work that he did in the last 4 or 5 years. And I'm going to show that that is wrong. In a nutshell, if I don't get to it, he uses measures of inaccuracy and disturbance which actually are not operational. And this is a nice case study which shows that then using classical intuition, which makes these measures look very reasonable, can lead you to dubious consequences. And the last one here, Bohr's complementarity principle is wrong. Again, I would refer to Popper. We have talked about Popper's experiment on this conference already. The implication of it, if it came out in Popper's sense, would be that you can have information about the path of a particle and the momentum, which beats the uncertainty relation. If it were true, then that is also a violation of complementarity. That's wrong as far as I can tell. And, well, here as an illustration, I give you one recent failed attack on the complementarity principle. It's a nice experiment and a somewhat dubious interpretation given by the author. And that is Afshar's experiment. This picture is one in three. Let me tell you the first picture. I was hesitant to assigned too much homework at short notice to my son, Jonathan, who made these pictures for me just in the last very few days. So here is a double slit, A and B. I have a photon coming in here in a plane wave. Nothing else happened, and here was a screen, then we would see that interference pattern emerge. But we removed the screen and put a lens here of appropriate dimensions and strengths, and what we get is a geometrical image of the two. So these are the two, according to Bohr, complementary options, experimental setups, to either measure interference or determine the path. So Afshar comes along and makes this experiment, and excuse me, what he adds is a grating of wires actually, ideally, they would be detectors, which he puts at the minima of the interference pattern, the locations of the minima of the interference pattern, thin wires. And what he observes here is a slightly distorted image of the poles. And he claims that is a joint determination of proof that the interference pattern is still there, as well as being able to determine the path. As I said, I don't want to go into interpretational issues here. I'm not entirely sure about it myself here, but this has been refuted on various counts, and I don't review that. If you want to see the reaction to that, go to the Quantum Physics Archive. Bill Unruh has given his version, and philosophers like Ruth Kastner have, and several physicists have tried themselves on that. I only have a little comment to make. I think this experiment is useful for an illustration of a result we had many years ago, and perhaps that also takes the tension out of it. I think it is a valid confirmation of complementarity in a way, in the sense that it doesn't contradict it. So here is how. We have this old theorem which says that spectral projections of position and momentum may indeed commute in some cases. And they do so exactly when the sets X and Y are periodic sets with minimal periods alpha and beta positive, satisfying this relation, 2 pi h bar over alpha times beta is equal to a natural number. So position and momentum are not, in the strongest possible sense, non-commutative. They have some spectral projections that do. Well, this is not totally surprising because we know from the Weil operators, the phase space position translation and momentum translation unitaries, that they commute under those conditions. So this is it. But that means, well, the consequence for our experiment here is to see that the state emerging in our two-slit experiment and its Fourier transform, they satisfy this periodicity condition with n equal to 1. So here we have, now this is the extension of the picture. I suggest we look at this as a truncated multi-slit, periodic multi-slit, infinite periodic multi-slit, and this here is a truncated infinite periodic multislit. And what we see here is, of course, the geometrical image of the momentum distribution. So we have that periodicity condition satisfied. And we don't have to bother about the far outside ends of this grating because of we can choose a suitable preparation here. What we get then with this state is a pretty good approximation of a simultaneous eigenstate of those spectral projections, of those functions of position and momentum. So what I would say is that Afshar's experiment is actually an approximate simultaneous measurement of the two commuting functions of position and momentum. It's a very reduced interference measurement. It only makes a negative measurement of the interference pattern, and therefore no surprise that it's doesn't confirm the full interference. So that's a coarse-grained and therefore feasible joint measurement of position and momentum. Well, here's my main message on the uncertainty principle, namely that it has in fact three phases. The first is that you all know very well. T is a quantum state, delta Q represents the, or describes, is a, denotes the standard deviation of the position distribution in that state. Delta P, the momentum, the standard deviation of the momentum distribution, and this is the Heisenberg inequality. Heisenberg, Robertson, Schrödinger, I might say, to do formal justice to those who put it on solid formal grounds. Second version comes intuitively in Heisenberg's paper quite explicitly, but vaguely as well. And that is to do with the inaccuracy, individual inaccuracy of position readings and momentum readings in a joint measurement of position and momentum. And it should have, that product should have a lower bound dictated by H bar. And finally, one that describes the accuracy of position measurements followed by a momentum measurement, and that would be a measure of disturbance for momentum due to that measurement. And this is also floating around in Heisenberg's examples. You can distill it from there, and he's quite explicit about it, as is Pauli and many others after them. So that is the one which refers to that phrase that measurement disturbs the quantum system. Well, here's the, in a nutshell, the example that Heisenberg apparently favored. The single slit, you may assume to have measured momentum sharply, so that goes into a slit, you measure an unsharp position here, and as a result, your momentum information gets distorted quite heavily, but not totally, because that moment, that position measurement is pretty unsharp. You still see residual information about the momentum. You see, for instance, the direction. You can determine the direction pretty well here of those momenta. And yeah, there's a width to that distribution. So the information does get distorted, but not destroyed entirely. There's a sense in which this constitutes a joint measurement of position and momentum. It's also an expression or a realization of the state, the preparation uncertainty relation, here described in terms of some measures of width, which I don't define here, and we have such an inequality again, which has been confirmed in neutron interferometry measurements and atom interferometry measurements by Zeilinger et al. Rather recently. Well, let me look at some case studies here, and I rush here. Much of that, of the next slides, many of those will just appear in the proceedings, and I don't bother to read them to you. The time would be too short, and I didn't have time to time my talk too much. So let me be quick here. Classic examples, as I mentioned, Heisenberg's Slits diffraction. Heisenberg's gamma microscope discussion has this dubious thing about the identification of the source of inaccuracy, disturbance with the kicks. There's something else going on, and Heisenberg in 1927, or at least 2030, refers to 1930 refers to the Doppler effect momentum measurement. And he says to make that a good measurement, you have to have long wavelengths so that the momentum disturbance gets low. And he goes with that and comes away with an uncertainty relation, because then the accuracy with which you could have your position determined is bad. In that example, I believe he does indeed identify the disturbance more with the collapse of the wave function that's going to happen in that. So another point to note is that in Heisenberg's examples, there's a big emphasis on measurements being repeatable measurements. That is, they collapse the system into an eigenstate or near eigenstate of the measured observable. That's quite clearly visible in all the examples. So here's a definition of repeatability. In terms of our instruments for a measurement, apply the instrument once for a measurement with an outcome X, and then repeat the measurement. What's the probability to get X again? Well, this is this expression. And if it's equal to the original probability, then we know we have produced the result and can repeat it with certainty. I think the battery is running out on this one, so. Thanks for that, anyway. Now comes the important part of the talk in red. Yeah, there's a nice theorem that goes back to Davies, Ozawa, and Wuchak in increasing generality, that if a measurement is repeatable, or I should say an instrument is repeatable, then the measured observable has to be discrete. That is quite a limitation on measurements of continuous observables to begin with. Well, I skipped the next few ones. Everybody knows what Lüders measurements are opposed to von Neumann measurements, projective measurements of different types. Lüders measurements are ideal, and Lüders theorem tells us if we have two observables, we measure observable A here in spectral representation, then a subsequent measurement of B feels that impact of the measurement of A exactly when B and A do not commute. So that is what we are looking for. If we want to see the disturbance of a quantum system due to a measurement, we have to subsequently measure non-commuting observables. We know that already. There is a generalization of that to unsharp observables, and the surprising result is due to Gutter and co, which says that in that case, the generalized Lüders measurements may not have that property. Commutativity may not be necessary for non-disturbance. That's quite curious. Some myths here about repeatable measurements. Some people say all measurements are repeatable. That was the old view. Then came Pauli already and distinguished between first kind and second kind measurements, where the second kind are the non-repeatable ones. So there was awareness all around about that. Whoops. Repeatable measurements are bad, for instance, unrealistic. The fact is that repeatable measurements are good for some purposes, bad for others. Repeatable measurements can be pretty well approximated, and they are quite important in many contexts, such as quantum non-demolition and quantum Zeno. Here's my pet model of an uncharged position measurement that goes back to von Neumann. Whoops, not so fast. Our object is described as a particle in one dimension, as is the probe, and this is our coupling. The position gets coupled with the momentum, which acts as a shift of the position of the probe and makes this shift proportional to the position. So then the measured observable in this, according to our measurement theory formulas, comes out to be a smeared position. It's a convolution of the spectral measure with a distribution function, which is determined by the initial preparation of the probe and the interaction strength. And you see from that, the bigger the interaction strength, the narrower this distribution, the sharper the measurement gets, which one would expect. We can also look at the state change in this measurement, and it comes out to be like a soft or fuzzy projection onto, well, some quantum states here determined by the state of the probe. Von Neumann looked at this. He did not use it to define the measured observable being a POVM. He was so close to introducing POVMs into quantum mechanics here, but he didn't. He looked at correlations between the output, the pointer observable, and the statistics of the position of the object after the measurement. So he showed that way that this is an approximately repeatable measurement of position. It has taken much longer to give an explicit model of a sharp position measurement in terms of unitaries. And here is Ozawa's model. This is a very complicated looking unitary, can be written in a somewhat simplified way. And I'll cut it short, the measured observable given that comes out to be the sharp position, and this is the state change. Notice that the probabilities are here, dependent on the input state, of course, and they are given by just a position spectral measure. And that is a weight factor on those states, which are shifts, position shifted states equal to the input state of the apparatus, which is copied into the object system here. That's what it is. Oh, yeah, here's one for Abner. And I better come to a close soon after that. So let me run this and put it up as a question for Abner. The Wigner-Araki-Yanase theorem in the original form states that if a sharp observable admits a repeatable measurement, then it commutes with any bounded additive conserved observable of the object apparatus system. Shimoni and Stein dropped the repeatability and extended the theorem in that way. They raised questions about the cases of continuous and unbounded quantities and also conserved quantities in that problem. And as such, it is an open problem. But if we look at an example, namely a measurement of position using the modified the von Neumann model, well, that would violate momentum conservation. But it's easily modified into something that does respect momentum conservation, because total momentum commutes with relative position. So that's manifest here. What we get is the measured observable is, again, an unsharp position, but now with a different scaling function coming into the uncertainty distribution that I need to make the convolution. So that's the form. It's, again, an unsharp position. You could, of course, here object that, well, you still need to measure the position of your probe, and there the problem repeats. So I'm trying to preempt that by suggesting that I measure that I introduce an unsharp pointer probe observable, itself an unsharp position, and then the measured observable turns out to be still an unsharp position with the convolution of those two uncertainty distributions. So the message here is that the accuracy can be as good as you like. And I was wondering whether for Abner that was good enough, or whether he still insists in a strict no-go theorem for sharp measurements, and that we don't have. Well, there should now be a part to do with precise measures of accuracy and disturbance, but I want to cut this really short. The general idea, at least, is for the accuracy, we make a measurement of position. We would get the distribution of position. We could also make an unsharp measurement of position, and we get a smeared distribution, okay. And then the accuracy of that unsharp measurement is to be determined in terms of a comparison of those two PUVMs. Disturbance, likewise, we may make a measurement of position, and that's that, and we get the sharp distribution, or we may make a measurement of momentum, that is, and get a sharp momentum distribution, or we may make a position measurement and see what the momentum distribution looks like after that. And that gives me a distorted momentum observable. We can do that sharply or unsharply for position and get a distorted, two types of distorted momenta. And we would compare these to the undistorted to get a measure, a feel for the disturbance. So that's how one would approach that operationally. Well, Ozawa got this wrong. I skipped this part. That's can do without that. Oh, I have to jump ahead. Ozawa's measures are like this. He introduced a noise operator, which is the pointer compared to what he wants to measure. That sounds reasonable. It is reasonable. For the disturbance, well, this is talking in terms of a position measurement, and the disturbance is measured in terms of looking at the momentum. So the disturbance of the momentum is the momentum after the measurement interaction and before, and the comparison between those. So that's fine. But what then happens is he squares these operators and takes the expectation. And there he introduces an operator that is not determined by the statistics of his measurement, so it's not determinable in that experiment. Only in specific cases, models, where it would work, but not in general. And that leads him to deduce this rigorous and valid modified trade-off relation between his measures of inaccuracy and disturbance and then additional terms. And if you look at this carefully, you can have sharp position measurements here with a finite value for the disturbance. And this would be zero, this would be zero, and still satisfy this uncertainty relation with a violation of the disturbance accuracy relation. But I claim this is due to the non-operational character of his measures. So Leinhard Werner's measure is roughly like this. Look at functions of a POVM. These are all whose expectations are all given by the distributions that you measure. You test these functions G, L of GE, by a selection of functions set which have this property. They are bounded. They have this Lipschitz property. And then you take the supremum of the norm distance, difference between those functions for the actually measured observable and the one you want to measure, or the one that is originally there and the disturbed one. And that is a neat measure, operational measure for a comparison of two POVMs. And I end by showing you Werner's very recent uncertainty relation, which is actually universally valid. Delta Q is the position measurement inaccuracy in these terms, dp is the momentum disturbance in these terms. And he finds that it's greater or equal C times H bar, and there's a specific determination of C. And in the ideal, the optimal case, it lies at around about 0.3 for this sort of measure. And this applies to von Neumann's position measurement model and the model and Ozawa's sharp position measurement model, whereas Ozawa's own measures would indicate a violation of this uncertainty relation. So to summarize, things you want to remember, perhaps. The first, why it makes sense to use T or W to denote state operators. There are three phases of complementarity and uncertainty principles, and we have to be careful with measures of accuracy and disturbance. You need a high degree of discretion if they are non-operational, guided by classical intuition. And there are useful operational measures which give a rigorous formulation of those uncertainty relations. Thank you very much. Well, there is a lot to be done to generalize these ideas to other pairs of observables. I refer to that paper that I did with my research student, Chris Schillerday. There we do Macht-Zehnder setups of all kinds and variations. And as an example there, we give measures of a trade-off between those two complementary possibilities of marking, determining the path, and seeing interference to a certain, well, measure level of attenuation at the same time. And what we discovered there was that some of these trade-off quantities link quite nicely with also the full Schrödinger uncertainty relation. It's a nice exercise I want to put to you. If you take the sigma x, sigma y for spin half, sigma x, sigma y uncertainty relation in its full beauty, you can actually delta sigma x. Can I do that by heart? I like sigma z better than y, so delta sigma x squared, delta sigma z squared, greater or equal a half sigma x sigma z commutator squared plus a half, and then comes the anti-commutator correlation squared, something like that, maybe modulus squared here. Thank you. So that is actually quite curiously equivalent to this triple uncertainty relation. I think it's a nice exercise for a quantum mechanics course. Anyway, what I wanted to say is this additional term does then figure in measures in those trade-off relations. So yeah, there is scope for that to be relevant. Yes. You mean the mixture of the spin states? The entanglement comes quite at the start in the correlation that's being built up between the spin and the position degree of freedom, which is the probe. Well, yeah, it means measuring apparatus or probe, anything that belongs to that long finger that points to the object. And in that case, yeah, it would be the position of the particle itself.